For people in Sudan, a bus ride out of the country means hope for safety right now. Just getting on board, though, is what one passenger called the hardest decision of her life.
I know that this is for the better. I know this is for our safety. But it's not easy to just leave your home and go away. And what makes it even worse is that you don't even know if you're ever going to come back.
I'm Marco Werman. Also, the White House hosts a state dinner for South Korea's president. But spying on friends could make things awkward between the two allies.
This might be a real big disaster.
On the plus side, the food should be tasty. A classic Korean condiment is on the menu.
Gochujang is typically not that spicy, not like a Mexican or Thai fiery spice. It's a very rounded, warm spice.
Those stories and much more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Joe Biden is hosting South Korea's President Yoon Suk-yeol today, highlighting what the White House calls an ironclad security alliance.
Over the past seven decades, our alliance has grown stronger and more capable. And the cooperation between our people, our commitment to one another, has grown deeper across every aspect of our partnership.
President Yoon is a guest of honor tonight at Biden's second ever state dinner. But this visit might also get awkward because the Pentagon documents leaked 2 weeks ago revealed that the U.S. has been listening in on conversations at South Korea's presidential office. Back home, President Yoon faces pressure to stand up in person to Biden. The World's Patrick Nguyen reports.
Is there any world leader the U.S. won't spy on? Maybe not if America tapped President Yoon's office. South Korea's leader is very pro-U.S. He's tough on China and North Korea. He's everything the U.S. establishment could possibly want. So many South Koreans are asking, is this how you treat your friends?
Most people are surprised and a little bit mad.
Uk Yang is a defense analyst at the Asan Institute for Policy Studies. He says President Yoon's team desperately wants this story to go away.
Yes, I mean, they don't want to talk about it.
First, Yoon's team claimed the leaked documents were fake. Then backtracked, saying even brothers will have disputes and can we all move on? But the story is not disappearing. Not with Yoon coming to dinner at the White House tonight, an event scheduled months ago. State dinners are black tie affairs with A-list celebrities and lots of pomp. The White House band welcoming French President Emmanuel Macron to a state dinner 4 months ago. That was Biden's very first one. Yoon will be his second. It's a big honor. But Yang, the analyst, says Koreans want to see if their leader has the guts to say, knock off the spying to Biden's face.
This might be a real big disaster for both Korea and U.S.
Past leaks have shown the U.S. will spy on core allies like Germany or France. The latest leaks show snooping on Egypt and Ukraine, too. Almost no country is immune. Uk Yang, who also advises the South Korean government, says insiders like himself are a bit jaded when it comes to American spying.
I know that they would love to hear what the important people says, even a friendly country.
And what are Yoon and his cabinet discussing behind closed doors, according to the wiretaps? They're worried about the war in Ukraine. The U.S. wants South Korea to send weapons to Ukraine as it fends off Russian invaders. South Korea wants to please Washington, but fears angering Moscow, and for good reason. Just days ago, the Kremlin said to South Korea, if you do arm Ukraine, we might do the same with your enemy, North Korea. And Yang says that would be a big problem.
North Korea has been developing nuclear weapons, but there's a missing technology for some of the missile system.
Russia could supply that missing technology, helping North Korea advance its most powerful weapon, ICBMs, intercontinental ballistic missiles that can reach the U.S. That's North Korean TV 2 weeks ago proclaiming the launch of a groundbreaking new missile, the first to use solid fuel, which makes launches harder for the U.S. to spot and sabotage. Yang says Russia could do wonders for improving North Korea's ICBM technology.
That should be a really big problem for U.S. rather than South Korea, so United States have to prepare for some of the outcomes.
These are outcomes from pressuring an ally, South Korea, to get involved in a war far away in Europe. With so much at stake, Yang says, President Yoon probably will not make a scene at the White House dinner. He will not want to come off as rude.
It might be too rude to directly ask those questions or have any disagreement.
Instead, Yoon could gently suggest that U.S. intelligence agencies make it up to him, perhaps by supplying more U.S. intel on North Korea in a more timely manner.
The U.S. usually give intelligence, but the thing is that it's kind of late.
He says South Korea has every reason to want more access to American intelligence. After all, the U.S. can tap into all sorts of secret places, something President Yoon has learned the hard way. For The World, I'm Patrick Nguyen.
Okay, now let's get down to what really matters at today's state visit, the menu for dinner. These menus are never simple things. Every dish is carefully considered, taste-tested, and adjusted with a culinary nod toward the guests. For tonight's meal, the White House brought in Korean-American celebrity chef Edward Lee to consult on the dishes. Those dishes feature both local, like Maryland crab cakes, for example, and Korean flavors. One thing we noticed on the menu was gochujang. It's a spicy red chili paste, very popular in Korean cooking, and it's being used in a vinaigrette this evening. Mina Park knows a thing or two about the condiment. She's co-owner of Baru and Shiku restaurants in Los Angeles. I'm a big fan of gochujang, Mina. There's red chili involved. Whenever that's involved, I'm there. But other ingredients, too. What is in gochujang?
So gochujang is made with Korean dried chili powder. That's what gives it that red color and then the heat. But the base is also cooked glutinous rice, barley malt, and fermented soybean powder, as well as jochang, which is fermented rice syrup. So all of these flavors are fermented together, ideally in a big earthenware pot, as it was made traditionally. And it can ferment for at least 6 months and up to a couple of years.
Yeah, so that fermented part really makes gochujang stand out from other chili sauces.
Yes, the longer it's fermented, the more complex and deep the flavor is. So you really want to find something that was made traditionally and has been allowed to meld and evolve over time.
Are you surprised that it's making an appearance at tonight's state dinner for the president of South Korea, even in a vinaigrette?
I'm not surprised, actually, because it is such an important ingredient. So soy sauce, ganjang, fermented soybean paste, doenjang, and then we have the chili pepper paste, which is gochujang. So these three ingredients, the jangs, really are the basis for Korean cooking. So I'm not surprised at all that it's showing up on the menu.
Well, we caught up yesterday with a couple of people stocking up on gochujang at the Asian grocery store H Mart, the one in San Diego, and they told us how they use it.
Stir fries, soups, banchan, which is like the side dishes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And another woman named Joyce says she uses gochujang all the time.
We need it. Korean people, we need it on any meals, breakfast, lunch, or dinner on the side dish.
Yeah, breakfast, lunch, and dinner. So your restaurant, Shiku, in Los Angeles' Grand Central Market, Mina, it's very much about comfort food. At Shiku, how do you use gochujang?
Well, we use it in a number of ways, but I think probably our most popular use of gochujang is with our spicy Korean fried chicken. So the sauce that the fried chicken is tossed in has a gochujang base.
Mm, and it's got kind of a sweet thing going on too, doesn't it?
I would say gochujang is typically not that spicy, not like a Mexican or Thai fiery spice. It's a very sort of rounded, warm spice. And so for the Korean fried chicken, there's a sweet element, there's garlic and savory element, and then also the heat from the gochujang.
What if I'm not making a strictly Korean meal, Mina? Do you ever roll it into like a barbecue sauce, for example?
Oh, yeah, that's a very common way you can see these days. Actually, gochujang has been appearing on restaurant menus, non-Korean restaurant menus recently, and it's been really fun to see all the different ways that non-Koreans have been experimenting with gochujang.
Yeah, I mean, we are seeing gochujang increasingly in supermarkets as a flavor on restaurant menus, now on the menu at a White House state dinner. What's going on, do you think?
You know, Korean culture has really exploded in recent years. So you have K-pop and BTS, you have Korean film and television that has really become popular kind of worldwide. So I think Korean food has ridden that wave. And so we're really seeing heightened interest in Korean food, which is amazing for Korean chefs like us.
Mina Park is co-owner of the Baru and Shiku restaurants in Los Angeles. She's also a big fan of the Korean chili paste known as gochujang. Mina, thank you very much. Good to speak with you.
Thank you so much for having me.
The mastermind behind the deadly suicide attack at the crowded Kabul airport back in 2021 has been killed. The White House released this information but did not identify the person. He is said to be a member of the terror group called ISIS-K. U.S. officials also said that Americans were not involved in the operation that killed the suspect. Here's the world's Shirin Jafari with more.
This was the scene at Abbey Gate, Kabul airport in 2021.
Hey, stop short! Stop short!
The U.S. military was in the midst of pulling out of Afghanistan after two decades of war.
Hey, Brett, can I get you to reinforce this?
Throngs of Afghans desperate to leave the country clamored to get inside the airport. The Biden administration deployed additional troops to beef up security. But on the afternoon of August 26, ISIS-K took advantage of the chaos and confusion. A suicide bomber detonated an explosive belt. It was followed by gunfire. 13 American service members died, and so did 170 Afghans. Later, in a speech, President Biden spoke directly to those behind the attack.
We will not forget. We will hunt you down and make you pay.
Fast forward to 2023, and it's not the U.S. who made them pay, but the Taliban.
Another terrorist being off of the face of the earth, I'm good with that.
Darren Hoover is the father of Marine Sergeant Taylor Hoover, who was among the Americans killed that day. U.S. officials told him the news this week. Speaking with ABC News, he demanded a full investigation into what led to his son's death.
All we want is answers.
So far, the name of the ISIS-K mastermind and details about how he was killed have not been released. A Taliban spokesman confirmed the killing to me, but did not answer follow-up questions. There's a reason behind this secrecy, says Colin Clark. He's the director of research at the Su Fong Group, a security and intelligence firm in New York.
My sense is that this is probably to protect what we call sources and methods, so how the United States gleaned the intelligence that this individual's killed.
He says the U.S. might also be planning upcoming attacks, sort of piggybacking off of this one. The U.S. military was not involved in the operation in Afghanistan, American officials say. But Clark says ISIS-K is a target for both the U.S. and the Taliban.
That's really just a coincidence in the fact that they have a shared enemy. So ISIS-K is a group that's trying to outflank the Taliban, trying to recruit Afghans and others in the region.
Since the Taliban took over Afghanistan in 2021, they have gone after ISIS-K in raids and targeted operations. Asfandiar Mir, a counterterrorism expert at the U.S. Institute of Peace, says the Taliban have even tried to preemptively arrest individuals who they think might join the group.
And they've been on this propaganda offensive against ISIS-K, trying to message to Afghan civilians that ISIS-K is effectively a terrorist organization, even as per their sort of definition.
The news about this recent operation also reveals changes in the Taliban's capabilities, Mir says.
Up until recently, they were not able to target senior leaders of the group, despite those senior groups regularly challenging them and their right to rule.
As for the U.S. military, it has no real on-the-ground presence in Afghanistan now, but that hasn't stopped its global fight against ISIS. In recent weeks, the U.S. says it has carried out several operations against ISIS in Syria and Iraq. For The World, I'm Shirin Jafari.
You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're listening to The World. Consider for a moment what some people around the globe have experienced just in the past 2 years. Disasters, natural and man-made, and military conflict. These crises have affected civilian lives and also been drivers of food insecurity around the world. Our next guest is responsible with helping to alleviate that food insecurity as regional director of the World Food Program for Eastern Europe and the MENA region, that's the Middle East and North Africa, Corinne Fleischer. The World Food Program was already bringing food to millions of people before the war in Ukraine and the earthquakes in Turkey and Syria. How did your organization respond to these two events?
Well, let me start with Turkey and Syria. The moment we heard of the earthquake, we put our emergency machinery in place. We started distributing the first day to 6,500 people, second day 36,000, then 150,000, and we then came to 1 million within 10 days. Now in Turkey, we're still supporting about 500,000 people, but we will wind this down within the next 1 or 2 months, and the government will take this over. In Ukraine, the situation is different. The war is going on, and the World Food Program is required to continue to support 3 million people every month, mainly at the front lines. And, you know, as the war continues, more people require assistance.
Ms. Fleischer, you've been in Washington the past few days, briefing leaders and looking for support. What has been your message and ask for U.S. leaders about conditions in the areas you serve?
The MENA region, the Middle East and Northern Africa, has been most impacted by the war in Ukraine. You know, food prices are going through the roof because they import so much. In Syria, prices are now 13 times higher than just 3 years ago. So imagine you pay $4 for a kilo of tomatoes. This is now $52. So people are completely at the edge.
Right.
But our prices has also gone up, right? Food prices go up. We buy food. We transport food. Oil prices have gone up. So we need more money. And this is what I am discussing and have discussed with the government here.
Right. And the U.S. is the biggest donor country supporting the World Food Program. The U.S. is itself going through its own budget fight. So how do politics in Washington play into support for the World Food Program?
So last year, you know, the government of the U.S. has increased their support to the World Food Program massively. And, you know, it's going to be difficult to keep that level of support. We're discussing that with all the governments. I'm just on my way after to Brussels and then to Germany, how we keep that support up. And then, you know, if we can't meet all the needs, then we're discussing how do we start prioritizing.
Go back to why it will be difficult to maintain this level of support from the U.S.
Well, I guess across the world with the economic downturn, it is very difficult for our donors. You know, they have to look at their own economies, at their own people. But, you know, in the MENA region, if we don't provide enough support, the issue is going to go beyond hunger. You know, we are working in places like Yemen, in places like Syria. And so we're almost the replacement of a government social safety net. And if that drops, what will people do? I mean, we've already seen a massive rise in migration to Europe. And, you know, extremism is coming back on the table. And, you know, a poor family, what will they do to support their children? Well, they will take any job they can. And there are a lot of militias around in this region that are starting to recruit people. And so that's a big security concern that we have in the region.
So a moment ago, Ms. Fleischer, you mapped out the global dependency on Ukraine for grain. There's concern that the Black Sea Grain Initiative may not be renewed. It expires in mid-May, and Russia's foreign minister has threatened not to renew it. What happens to plans for sending food to places like Yemen if cargo ships are stuck in the Black Sea?
Well, that is a disaster. I mean, one, if there is again a blockage, prices will go up for sure. And currencies in the Middle East have plummeted, and they're already struggling with local currencies to buy food on the international markets because their purchase power just drops when your currency plummets, no? But then if the prices go up in addition, you know, there will be, you know, countries that will just go bankrupt. And again, what will happen? The World Food Program will come in and help those people in those countries survive.
Corinne Fleischer is the regional director of the World Food Program for Eastern Europe, the Middle East, and North Africa. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you so much, Marco.
There's a reason why it's called a moonshot. A Japanese company hoping to land a small spacecraft on the moon failed this week. The company called iSpace lost contact with its lunar lander Tuesday. They think it crash-landed on the moon's surface. The world's Anna Kusmer reports.
The mood was somber at a museum in Tokyo yesterday. A crowd was there expecting to celebrate the first private company to land on the moon. Instead, iSpace's chief executive Takeshi Hakamada had other news.
We lost the communication. We have to assume that we could not complete the landing on the lunar surface.
Today, the company confirmed the robotic spacecraft ran out of fuel while trying to land. Simeon Barber is a researcher at the Open University in the UK and an expert on the lunar surface. He says landing on the moon is really hard.
There are fine margins in this business, and it only takes a couple of things to go against you. And, you know, you end up with a problem.
The spacecraft got really close to landing, so Barber doesn't think they failed. Rather, it's a step towards something bigger.
In order to achieve these big endeavors, you need to take some risks. And the kind of philosophy at the moment is learn by doing.
The fact that this particular flight failed is part and parcel with today's culture of commercial space programs, says Sarah Kreps, who directs the Tech Policy Institute at Cornell University. In some ways, she says, these commercial companies follow the logic of Silicon Valley. Fail fast, fail early, fail often.
There will be some failures, but that's how these commercial space firms learn.
And Kreps says this new space race seems to be accelerating. Commercial space programs have tripled their investment funding in the last 15 years, from around $100 billion in 2005 to more than $350 billion in 2020, according to Morgan Stanley.
It is, I might say, a meteoric increase in investment in space.
Kreps says the race is between individual firms, but also between countries. U.S. and China are big players, as well as smaller countries like Israel, Singapore, and Japan. Which brings us to another private company with galactic ambitions. In Texas last Thursday, crowds looked on as a SpaceX rocket exploded minutes after takeoff. But the company is saying this wasn't a failure. The whole point of the launch was to see what doesn't work.
I think one of the aspects of this being a space race is that it creates a very ambitious trajectory. And so everyone kind of wants to be the first.
Kreps says she expects many companies might see these crashes and pump the brakes just a little. There's no substitute for time and experience.
So what I would expect to see now is a bit more of a kind of incrementalism, sequencing out of stuff rather than shooting for the moon on the first try. Because I think there's this realization that ambitions don't guarantee success.
The new space race may feel like a sprint, but really it's a marathon. For The World, I'm Anna Kussmer.
More stories from around the globe still coming your way this hour. You're listening to The World. China's president picks up the phone and calls Ukraine's president, the first time since the start of Russia's full-scale invasion. Ukrainian officials hope it boosts relations between the two countries.
Zelensky is the leader of a country that needs as many friends as it can get.
And Chile's new plans for mining a key metal for electric car batteries. All that's still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're listening to The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. In Sudan, over the last week and a half, around 500 people have been killed in fighting between rival armed forces. Several thousand have been injured. Today, that fighting between the Sudanese army and a paramilitary group continued, despite a short-term ceasefire. The United Nations is calling it only partially successful. Volker Perthes is the UN Special Representative for Sudan.
As fighting continues, law and order will further break down throughout the country. Sudan could become increasingly fragmented, which would have a devastating impact on the region. And even if one side wins, Sudan will lose.
Caught in the middle are civilians. The violence in Khartoum especially has forced Sudanese residents from the capital region to make tough decisions about whether to stay or leave. The World's Africa correspondent Halima Gikandi is following the news from Nairobi, Kenya, and brings us this story about people fleeing the fighting in Sudan by bus.
The big questions for so many people in Khartoum the past few days have been, when do we leave? How do we get out? And where do we go? That's what Mohamed Al-Mubarak Kibeda and his family have been debating.
Trying to figure out how to get from Khartoum to a location where we could have an ease of migrating was extremely difficult.
Along the way, Kibeda recorded voice notes and sent them to me on WhatsApp. All of the routes out of Khartoum come with their own risks and challenges, and there's no guarantee they will be let into neighboring countries when they arrive at the border. As they discuss their options, he says bus drivers kept raising their prices.
They should be labeled as war profiteers because they've been doing the worst they can do.
His family pooled their resources, and finally, on Tuesday morning, they decided to head north to the border with Egypt. First, they managed to rent a van to get across town. It takes them through the nearly empty streets of Khartoum, and they arrive at a crowded bus station.
We're here at what is called Gandahar. It's a large location at the edge of Omdurman, where it's a travel and tourism bus station. So there's a lot of buses. At this very moment, there is a lot of buses in front of me.
He and his family wait there in the heat. Finally, hours later, the bus starts the journey north.
The bus left the station around 3:30, and now it's 4:48. 4:48 means we have still long ways to go. But when I look back at it and I think about my cousin that we had to leave behind.
Kibeda tells me his cousin refused to leave Khartoum. His family had a big fight over it. But his cousin wanted to stay and fight for the revolution. It's been going on for the past 4 years, a fight for a civilian-led government. That's all been derailed by this conflict. Kibeda says his cousin called him earlier in the day.
To remind us of the atrocities that we're escaping, he let us know that bombardment have commenced in Omdurman. And everybody's wondering, why does the ceasefire only happen on TV and it doesn't happen for the people?
On the long drive, he talks with other people on the bus, recording them on his phone. One woman says she's still processing the past 12 days.
Living all the time in fear, in stress, in constant tension between the sounds of heavy artillery, having to be constantly worried about losing a family member, a friend, the person you love. Constantly hearing about people's houses getting destroyed, constantly hearing about people dying.
She says she never imagined having to flee her home.
This is the hardest decision I had to take with my family. This is the hardest feeling I've ever felt in my life. I know that this is for the better. I know this is for our safety. But it's not easy to just leave your home and go away. And what makes it even worse is that you don't even know if you're ever going to come back. Am I ever going to come back? And if I come back, am I going to find my home? Is everyone I love going to be there? Is everyone going to be okay? Is Sudan going to be okay again one day?
These are the questions that linger for a lot of people. Mohamed Walid is also on this bus. He says he and his brother tried 3 times to get out of the capital after the fighting started. They're also trying to get to Egypt. He says he feels lucky to have made it on the bus. I hope our country will be at peace again. We've been through a lot, he says. But I know this will come to an end and the good times will return. For the world, I'm Halima Gekandi in Nairobi.
China's government has said it wants to act as a mediator in Russia's war against Ukraine, but President Xi Jinping has never condemned Russia's full-scale invasion. In fact, Xi had not even picked up the phone to call Ukraine's Volodymyr Zelensky since the war started, until today when the two leaders spoke on the phone for more than an hour. Zelensky described the conversation as long and meaningful. Chinese officials were not quite so effusive. They confirmed the call, adding that China always stood on the side of peace. David Rennie is the Beijing bureau chief for The Economist, and he joins us from Beijing. David, is this phone call significant?
It definitely is significant. We wait to see over the next couple of days when we see the Chinese propaganda rollout how China presents this, because there are a couple of plausible reasons why Xi Jinping, as you say, finally after more than a year, picked up the phone and did what any number of Western leaders, particularly European leaders, have urged him to do, which is to put his money where his mouth is, given that he talks about playing a neutral role in this conflict. It's kind of shocking that he's had several very friendly personal one-on-one meetings with Vladimir Putin, but hadn't even called Vladimir Zelensky.
Can you help us get into the mindset of China's officials when it comes to Ukraine? What are they thinking?
China wants to discredit America and try and divide a wedge between America and Europe. China wants to discredit NATO, the defense alliance, because America has other defense alliances over here in Asia with the Japanese, with the South Koreans, and China hates those. And China wants to discredit sanctions that have been levied on Russia for the invasion of Ukraine because China's had sanctions levied on it over the years. And certainly, if one day China were to invade the island of Taiwan, it could expect any number of sanctions. So their view is that Putin, for all his flaws, is a useful ally in a giant contest against the United States.
I mean, given all of that, David, what do you think the propaganda is likely going to sound like in the next couple of days?
So there are two explanations. One is that this is genuinely because Xi Jinping thinks that there's some advantage for him in listening to the calls from, for example, European leaders to try and make peace. He's talked about sending a special representative from China to Ukraine and to other countries, which may or may not mean Russia. And, you know, potentially there is some speculation out there that China doesn't like the look of the spring offensive that's about to start, that perhaps it could go badly for Russia. And so they're trying to make it more difficult for Ukraine to launch that spring offensive. That's just a sort of speculation out there. So that leads you to explanation two, which is not nearly so comfortable for the Chinese, which is that the Chinese ambassador to France, Lu Xiaoye, had a disastrous train wreck of a television interview on French TV a few days ago, in which he was asked point blank by the French presenter, do you believe that Crimea is part of Ukraine? And instead of saying yes, which is China's official government position, he said, oh, well, it depends, and then went into this long rambling explanation about how all the former countries that used to be part of the Soviet Union, their legal status is somewhat ambiguous. And that then left the Chinese having to explain to any number of Central Asian countries or former Soviet countries in the Baltics why China actually believes they exist as sovereign countries. If that's the reason that Xi Jinping suddenly moved to make this call, then that suggests that it's really a cleanup of a disastrous blunder by China's ambassador to Paris.
Well, not surprisingly, Ukrainian officials have a very different take on the phone call. Zelensky said on Twitter that he thought the call, along with the appointment of an ambassador to Beijing from Ukraine, would give a powerful impetus to the development of our bilateral relations. David, do you think that's wishful thinking?
I think it's clever diplomacy and politics. Look, Vladimir Zelensky is not a fool. He can see for himself that China is not neutral and that China certainly doesn't want Putin to lose so badly that he becomes sort of destabilized or even to really pay a very high price for this aggression. But Zelensky is the leader of a country that needs as few powerful enemies as it can get. And for all China's manifest flaws and bias in this conflict, it is a permanent member of the Security Council, one of five. It is also potentially a country that could bail out Vladimir Putin with any amount of money or, you know, in the worst case scenario, weapons. So it's been really interesting and a sign of Vladimir Zelensky's kind of discipline over the last year that even as other European countries were very frustrated with China's position and its kind of repackaging of Russian talking points, the Ukrainians have never publicly criticize the Chinese. And I think that's just because they need all the friends they can get, as I say, and they don't want powerful enemies.
David, talk briefly about Chinese interests in this war. What does China stand to gain if the war in Ukraine continues, and what does it have to lose?
China believes it could be a winner from this war. It's a grim and sort of sad thing to say, but China is exceptionally uninterested in the fate of the Ukrainian civilians. I've not heard a single Chinese official express one moment of sympathy for dead Ukrainians. What do they want? So from a weaker Russia, they could get cheap oil and gas. They could pay for it with the Chinese currency. They're already saying to all of their friends in the developing world, in Africa, in South Asia, in Latin America, look at your high food prices. That's the fault of the wicked Americans and other Western countries for sanctioning Russia. And so for China, this is actually a diplomatic opportunity. The one caveat is that if Vladimir Putin loses so badly that he is destabilized and that brings chaos and turmoil in Russia, that's bad for two ways for Russia, for China. That leaves a massive neighbor in chaos on their border. They don't like that. And also, they don't want the Americans to have the win of a collapsed, imploded Russia. So for those reasons, this isn't a comfortable situation. I don't think China would have chosen this war, but they are coldly and calculatedly trying to work out how they could end up as a winner.
David Rennie is the Beijing bureau chief for The Economist. He joined us from China's capital to talk about today's phone call between China's leader Xi Jinping and Ukraine's Volodymyr Zelensky. David, thanks very much.
Thank you.
This next story takes us to the conflict between Armenia and Azerbaijan, specifically the territory contested by the two countries, Nagorno-Karabakh. Periodically, Armenia and Azerbaijan have fought over it going back to the late 1980s. The two countries are currently negotiating a peace deal. In the meantime, Azerbaijan is taking steps to impose its will on the ground. The World's Daniel Offman explains.
In 2020, the long-running conflict over Nagorno-Karabakh erupted again. The fighting between Armenia and Azerbaijan lasted 44 days. Azerbaijan gained control of large amounts of territory in the region. Later, Russia helped broker a ceasefire and sent in peacekeepers. But the conflict is not resolved. Since December of last year, protesters from Azerbaijan claiming to be environmental activists have been blocking movement between Armenia and Nagorno-Karabakh. This week, Azerbaijan's military went a step further. Richard Giragosian is the director of the Regional Study Center in the Armenian capital, Yerevan.
The most recent incident involved the establishment of a checkpoint by the Azerbaijani armed forces, cutting off and restricting access through the one lifeline connecting Armenia to Nagorno-Karabakh, the so-called Lachin Corridor.
More than 100,000 Armenians still live in Nagorno-Karabakh, and they depend on the Lachin Corridor. It's the only road that connects it to the rest of Armenia. Azerbaijan cutting off that road puts those Armenians in a difficult situation.
This is very much an escalation as it comes in the wake of 4 months of an ongoing siege of Nagorno-Karabakh, where the Russian peacekeepers seem either incapable or unwilling to actually enforce the terms of the Russian-imposed ceasefire agreement.
I think we should understand it in the light of what's happening in the Ukraine.
That's Sujat Ahmadzada. He's a research fellow at the Topchubasov Center think tank in Baku, Azerbaijan.
Russia's hands are tied up because of the decision made by Vladimir Putin to invade the Ukraine, and its capacity is getting tested, challenged in a way that Russia is not capable anymore of intervening in the same way that it was doing before the war in Ukraine.
Ahmadzada says that Azerbaijan is filling that vacuum created by Russia by imposing its will in Nagorno-Karabakh.
Azerbaijan chose a policy of having a long-term strategy to get the control over the rest of Karabakh, which it didn't get during the war.
And that policy has led to strong distrust from people in Armenia. Nonetheless, the two countries are working on a comprehensive peace deal.
There is a commitment problem for Armenia and Azerbaijan. Armenia has a deep fear that in case of something signed, Azerbaijan would not abide by, and that would result in ethnic cleansing of Karabakh Armenians or full exodus of them.
And given the history of violence between the two sides, those fears are well-founded. But Ahmadzada is still hopeful about the negotiation process. He says that in recent months, the two sides have been moving closer towards a deal. Here's Richard Giragosian again.
Armenia has come to a difficult decision, or even a realistic assessment, that it is a position of weakness, not strength. This is why the Armenian government is quite committed to the signing of a peace treaty with Azerbaijan in the coming months.
Giragosian says that Armenia is no longer pushing for self-determination, independence, or for the unification of Nagorno-Karabakh with the rest of Armenia.
Rather, it's about the protection of the Armenians of Nagorno-Karabakh and within the context of Azerbaijan's territorial integrity.
This policy shift is still controversial in Armenia, where much of the public is angry about Armenian losses during the 2020 war. For now, though, Armenians hope people around the world are paying attention to the plight of Armenians in Nagorno-Karabakh. Earlier this week, in a statement, the U.S. State Department called for free and open movement along the Lachin Corridor and for those peace talks to continue. For the World, I'm Daniel Hoffman.
Chile has announced that the government will take a controlling stake in all mining of lithium in the country. Lithium is key to making rechargeable batteries like the ones in electric vehicles, and Chile is one of the world's largest producers of lithium. To talk about what this means for Chile, we're joined by Patricia Vasquez. She's an energy expert and a global fellow with the Wilson Center's Latin America program. She's based in Buenos Aires. Patricia, Chile's President Gabriel Boric announced this change last week, and more details have been emerging. What do we know about how state control in the lithium sector is going to work?
The way I understand the strategy he just announced is that the government is not going to have a controlling stake in all future projects. On the contrary, what the government is proposing is creating a framework by which the government and the private sector could work together to develop future lithium projects in Chile.
I mean, there is some debate, as you probably know, over whether this qualifies as nationalization of the lithium industry. What's your stance?
There are two private projects currently operating in Chile. The government specifically clarified that those projects will not be expropriated. What the government did say is that they will have talks with both companies, SQM and Albemarle, to debate the possibility of the government becoming a partner in these two contracts that are currently ongoing. Not that the government is going to force itself into these contracts. So in my view, that is not a nationalization.
Got it. Now, what about business interests in Chile? Are they upset by this move?
A lot of private sector representatives were not happy with this announcement. I think the government just opened a space for debating with the private sector. They're going to sit down. In fact, they already started. And from those talks, I think, will come a model of private-public partnership for developing the lithium industry in the future.
I mean, it kind of feels, though, like this kind of positioning keeps the door open for both private and public investment in lithium. So it almost lets a government like Chile's to kind of sit and wait and see how the industry develops.
To be honest, Chile has so much lithium and it is of such good quality that I would venture to say that even if the government said we're going to take a 51% stake and there's so much such a supply crunch in the world that companies might come eventually in the future. Obviously, private funding and private know-how are needed in order to develop lithium, and that is everywhere. And I think that Chile is doing it a little bit different here.
Patricia Vasquez is an energy expert and a global fellow with the Wilson Center's Latin America program. Patricia, thank you very much. Really appreciate your time.
Thank you.
We got the news yesterday of the death of the legendary entertainer Harry Belafonte. He was 96. Belafonte also used his celebrity to advance black freedom struggles around the globe and in South Africa especially. The World's Sarah Birnbaum reports now on Harry Belafonte's role in the anti-apartheid movement.
On June 11, 1988, Harry Belafonte stood on the stage at London's Wembley Stadium. 70,000 people were there. Millions more were watching around the world. The occasion was Nelson Mandela's 70th birthday, and Belafonte was kicking off a marathon concert in Mandela's honor.
You will hear rock, pop, jazz, rhythm and blues, great music of every kind. But the message behind all of it is quite simple. We salute you, Nelson Mandela. And we want to see you and your fellow political prisoners free.
Belafonte liked to say, I wasn't an artist who became an activist. I was an activist who became an artist. In the 2011 documentary, Sing My Song, he said the seeds of his activism were planted when he was serving in the segregated U.S. Navy during World War II. Belafonte said he and other black soldiers fought white supremacy and fascism abroad, and they thought they'd be treated as equals when they got back home.
But at the end of the war, there was still segregation. We were still being lynched. We were still being harassed and murdered. And so we belonged to everything we could belong to. Overthrow this relentless cruelty of racist oppression.
Racist oppression in the U.S. and in the rest of the world. In 1977, Belafonte helped start Trans Africa, a lobbying group that pressed for economic sanctions against South Africa's apartheid government. In 1985, he was arrested for picketing outside the South African embassy in Washington, D.C. Belafonte continued to campaign for Nelson Mandela's freedom, and in late 1989, he got a call from an ANC activist. Nelson Mandela was going to be released from prison and then going on a tour of the U.S. Could Harry Belafonte arrange it? Mandela touched down at the airport on June 20th, 1990.
With a mixture of triumph and humility, Mandela arrived at John F. Kennedy Airport.
Belafonte was on the tarmac to meet him. He described the moment in the documentary Sing My Song.
We actually spoke for the first time the minute he stepped off the plane, landing in New York. He looked over the crowd, and when he spotted me, he recognized me with a big smile on his face. He said, "Ah, Harry boy."
Later that day, Belafonte introduced Mandela to a packed Yankee stadium.
"Comrades, brothers and sisters, fellow Americans, I give you Nelson Mandela."
He led the crowd in chanting Amandla, the Zulu word for power.
Amandla!
Harry Belafonte called himself an internationalist, a world citizen. He remained a devoted and relentless activist until his death, campaigning for the cause of freedom everywhere. For The World, I'm Sarah Birnbaum.
That's where we say farewell today. The World comes to you each weekday from the Nan and Bill Harris Studio at GBH in Boston and the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. We'll see you again right here tomorrow.
From PRX.